killed him. The defendant, sitting right over there, will try and confuse you, try and convince you that the law makes exceptions for people who temporarily or permanently lose their minds. Baloney. He rambles on a bit without notes, and I've known for some time that Max gets in trouble when he goes off script. The more skilled courtroom advocates convey the impression that they are speaking extemporaneously, while in truth they have spent hours memorizing and rehearsing. Max is not one of those, but he's not as bad as most prosecutors. He does a very smart thing by promising the jurors that they will soon see the now famous video. He makes them wait. He could, even at this initial stage of the trial, show the video. Goslow has already said so, but he teases them with it. Nice move. His opening statement is not long because his case is ironclad. Impulsively, I stand and tell Her Honor that I will reserve my opening statement until the beginning of our defense, an option under our rules. Max bounces forth and calls as his first witness the widow, Mrs. Beverly King. She's a nice-looking lady, dressed for church, and terrified of the witness chair. Max walks her through the standard sympathy ritual, and within minutes she's in tears. Though such testimony has nothing at all to do with guilt or innocence, it is always allowed to hammer home the fact that the deceased is indeed dead, and that he or she left behind loved ones. Sean was a faithful partner, devoted father, hard worker, breadwinner, loving son to his dear mother. Between sobs, we get the picture, and as always, it is dramatic. The jurors swallow it whole, and a few glare at Taddeo. I've yelled at him not to look at the jurors, but instead sit attentively at the table and scribble non-stop on a legal pad. Do not shake your head. Do not show any reaction or emotion. At any given time, at least two members of the jury are looking at you. I do not cross-examine Mrs. King. She is excused and returns to her seat next to her three children in the front row. It's a lovely family, on display for everyone, but especially the jurors. The next witness is the medical examiner, a forensic pathologist named Dr. Glover, a veteran of these battles. Because my career has involved a number of grisly murder cases, Dr. Glover and I have tangled before in front of juries. Indeed, in this very courtroom. He conducted an autopsy on Sean King the day after he died, and has photos to prove it. A month ago, Mancini and I almost came to blows over the autopsy photos. Normally, they are not admitted because their gruesomeness is so prejudicial. However, Max convinced Goslow that three of the milder ones are probative. The first is of Sean lying on the slab, naked but for a white towel over his midsection. The second is a close-up of his face, with the camera directly above him. The third is of his shaved head, turned to the right to reveal considerable swelling from several incisions. The 20 or so photos wisely excluded by Goslow are so graphic that no sane trial judge would allow the jury to see them. Sawing off the top of the skull, tight photos of the damaged brain, and the last one of the brain sitting alone on a lab table. The ones deemed admissible are projected on a tall, wide screen. Mancini walks the doctor through each one. The cause of death was blunt force trauma inflicted by repeated blows to the upper face. How many blows? Well, we have the video to show us. This is another smart move by Max, to introduce the footage with the medical expert on the stand. The lights go dim, and on the large screen we get to relive the tragedy. The two fighters in the center of the ring, both confident of victory. Sean King raises the right hand of Crush, who seems surprised. Taddeo's shoulders slump in disbelief. Then suddenly, he hits Crush from the side, a real sucker punch. Before Sean King can react, Taddeo lands a hard right to his nose, then a left. Sean King falls back and lands against the wire cage, where he sits, slumped over, defenseless, out cold. And Taddeo springs on him like an animal, pounding away. 22 blows to the head, Dr. Glover tells the jurors, who are mesmerized by the violence. They're watching a perfectly healthy man get beaten to death. And my idiot client thinks he'll walk. The video ends when Norberto rushes into the ring and grabs Tadeo. At that point, Sean King's chin is on his chest, and his face is nothing but blood. Crush is out cold. Chaos ensues as others scramble into the picture. As the riot breaks out, the screen goes black. Doctors tried everything to relieve the intense swelling of Sean King's brain, but nothing worked. He died 5 days later without regaining consciousness. An image of a CT scan takes the place of the video, and Dr. Glover talks about cerebral contusions. Another image, and he talks about hemorrhaging within the hemispheres. Another reveals a large subdural hematoma. The witness has been discussing autopsies and causes of death with juries for many years, and he knows how to testify. He takes his time, explains things, and tries to avoid esoteric words and phrases. This must be one of his easier cases because of the video. The victim was perfectly healthy when he walked into the cage. He left on a stretcher, and the world knows why. Arguing with a true expert in front of a jury is always tricky business. More often than not, the lawyer loses both the fight and his credibility. Because of the facts in this case, I have very little credibility to begin with. I'm not willing to lose any more. I stand and politely say, "No questions." When I sit down, Tadeo hisses at me.
"What are you doing, man? You gotta go after these dudes."
"Knock it off, okay?" I say through gritted teeth. I'm really tired of his arrogance, and he's obviously distrustful of me. I doubt if things will improve. Chapter 23. As we break for an afternoon recess, I get a text message from Miguel Zapata. I've seen him in the courtroom throughout the morning, one of several relatives and friends clustered in the back row, watching intently but from as far away as possible. We meet in the hallway and stroll outside. Norberto, the former manager of Team Zapata, joins us. Partner follows at a distance. I make sure they understand that Tadeo is refusing a very good plea bargain. He could be out in 18 months and fighting again. But they have a better deal. Juror number 10 is Esteban Suarez, age 38, a truck driver for a food supply company. 15 years ago, he immigrated legally from Mexico. Miguel says he has a friend who knows him. I hide my surprise as we wade into treacherous waters. We turn down a narrow one-way street with all sunlight blocked by tall buildings. "How does your friend know him?" I ask. Miguel is a street punk, a low-end drug runner for a gang that is heavily involved with cocaine smuggling, but not heavily involved with its profits. In the murky chain of distribution, Miguel and his boys are stuck in the middle with no room to grow. This is where Tadeo was when we met less than 2 years ago. Miguel shrugs and says,
"My friend knows lots of people."
"I'm sure he does. And when did your friend meet Mr. Suarez? Within the past 24 hours?
"It doesn't matter. What matters is the fact that we can deal with Suarez, and he's not that expensive. Bribing a juror can land you in the same pen with Tadeo." "Señor, please. For 10 grand, Suarez hangs the jury, maybe even gets an acquittal."
I stop walking and stare at this small-time thug. What does he know about acquittals? If you think that jury is going to let your brother walk, then you're crazy, Miguel.
Ain't gonna happen. "Okay, then we hang it. You said yourself that if they hang once, then hang twice, then the prosecutor will dismiss everything."
I start walking again, slowly, because I'm not sure where we're headed. Partner trails 50 yards behind. I say,
"Fine, go bribe a juror, but I'm not getting involved." "Okay, señor, give me the cash and I'll get it done."
"Oh, I see. You need the money."
"Yes, señor. We don't have that kind of cash."
"I don't either, especially not after representing your brother. I forked over 30 grand for a jury consultant and 20 for a shrink, plus 20 more for other expenses. Keep in mind, Miguel, in my business I'm supposed to get paid by the client, cash fees for representation. And the client also covers all expenses. It's not the other way around.
Is that why you're not fighting?
I stop again and glare at him.
You have no idea what you're talking about, Miguel. I'm doing the best I can with the facts I have. You guys are under some misguided notion that I can fit your brother into a big, mysterious loophole in the law and walk him out of there a free man. Guess what? It ain't going to happen, Miguel. Tell that to your hard-headed brother. We need 10,000, Rudd. And now. Too bad. I don't have it. We want a new lawyer. Too late.
Chapter 24. D is for donut. After another sleepless night, I meet Nate Spurio at a bakery near the university. For breakfast, he's having two honey-glazed filled with jelly and black coffee. I'm not hungry, so I choke down the coffee. After a few minutes of small talk, I say, "Look, Nate, I'm pretty busy these days. What's on your mind?"
"The trial, huh?"
"Yes."
"I hear you getting hammered."
"It's pretty ugly in there."
"You called. What's up?"
"Not much. I've been asked to pass along some kind words from Roy Kemp and family. They took the girl off to rehab someplace. She's a mess, obviously, but at least she's safe and with her family. I mean, look, Rudd, these people thought she was dead. Now they got her back. They'll do whatever it takes to make her whole again. And they might have a lead on the baby. This thing is still unfolding all over the country. More arrests last night, more girls taken into custody. They got a tip related to the baby-selling angle, and they're all over it."
I nod, take a sip, say, "That's good."
"Yes, it is. And Roy Kemp wants you to know that he and his family are very grateful to you for getting the girl back and making all this happen."
"He kidnapped my child."
"Come on, Rudd."
"His daughter was kidnapped, so he must know how it feels. I don't care how grateful he is. He's lucky I called off the FBI, or he might be sitting in jail."
"Come on, Rudd, let it go. There's a happy ending here, thanks to you."
"I deserve nothing, and I want no part of it. Tell Mr. Kemp to kiss my ass."
"Will do. They got a lead on Swanger. Last night, a tip from a bartender in Racine, Wisconsin."
"Great.
Can we meet in a week or so and have a beer? I'm rather preoccupied right now."
"Sure."
Chapter 25. I huddle with partner and Cliff in the hallway before the trial resumes Friday morning. At this point, Cliff's job is to sit in various places among the spectators and watch the jurors. His reaction to yesterday is not surprising. The jurors have no sympathy for Tadeo, and they've made up their minds. "Grab the plea deal if it's still on the table," he keeps saying. I tell him about my conversation with Miguel the day before. Cliff's response,
"Well, if you can bribe one, you'd better do it quick."
As the jury files in, I steal a look at Esteban Suarez. I planned to just glance at him quickly, as I normally do during trials. However, he's gawking at me as if he expects me to hand over an envelope. What a goofball. There's little doubt, though, that someone has made contact with him. There's also little doubt that he can't be trusted. Is he already counting his money? Judge Fabineau says good morning and welcomes everyone back to her courtroom. She goes through the standard routine of quizzing the jurors about any unauthorized contact with sinister people hoping to sway them. I glance back at Suarez. He's staring at me. I'm sure others are noticing this. Mr. Mancini stands and announces,
"Your Honor, the state rests. We may have additional witnesses for rebuttal, but for now we'll rest."
This is not surprising because Max gave me a heads up. He's called only two witnesses because that's all he needs. Again, the video says it all, and Max is wise to let it speak for itself. He's clearly established the cause of death, and he certainly nailed the perpetrator. I walk to the jury box, look at everyone but Suarez, and begin by stating the obvious. My client killed Sean King. There was no premeditation, no planning. He hit him 22 times, and Tadeo doesn't remember it. In the 15 or so minutes before he attacked Sean King, Tadeo Zapata was struck in the face and head a total of 37 times by Crush, also known as Bo Fraley. 37 times. He wasn't knocked out, but he was mentally impaired. He remembers little past the second round, when Crush landed a knee to his jaw. We will show you, the jury, the entire fight, count the 37 blows to the head, and prove to you that Tadeo did not know what he was doing when he attacked the referee. I am brief because there is just not much I can say. I thank them and leave the podium. My first witness is Oscar Moreno, Tadeo's trainer and the man who first saw his potential as a 16-year-old boxer. Oscar is about my age, older than Tadeo's gang, and he's been around the block. He hangs out in a gym for Hispanic kids and offers to train the more talented ones. He also happens to have a clean record, a real asset when calling witnesses to the stand. Past criminal convictions always come back to bite you. Juries are tough on felons under oath. With Oscar, I lay the groundwork for the events leading up to the fight. It's an effort to appeal to the jury's sense of compassion. Tadeo is a poor kid from a poor family whose only real chance in life so far has been inside the cage. We finally get around to the fight, and the courtroom lights go down. The first time through, we watch the fight without interruption. In the semi-darkness, I watch the jurors. The women are turned off by the sport's brutality. The men are thoroughly engrossed. During the rerun, I stop the tape each time Tadeo takes a shot in the face. The truth is that most of these were not that damaging, and Crush scored only minor points with them. But to jurors who don't know any better, a punch to the face, especially one blown out of proportion by Oscar and me, becomes a near-lethal blow. Slowly, methodically, I count them. When they are displayed in such exaggerated manner, one can easily ask how in the world Tadeo stayed on his feet. With 1:20 to go in the second round, Crush is able to yank Tadeo's head down and bang it into his right knee. It's a nasty shot, all right, but one that hardly fazed Tadeo. Now, though, Oscar and I make it look like the cause of permanent brain damage. I stopped the video after the end of the second round, and through carefully rehearsed questions and answers, I elicit from Oscar his impressions of his fighter between rounds. The kid's eyes were glazed over. He could only grunt, not speak. He was unresponsive to questions fired at him by Norberto and Oscar. He, Oscar, thought about waving the ref over and stopping the fight. I would put Norberto on the stand to verify these lies, but he has two felony convictions and would be humiliated by Mancini. Left unsaid in this testimony is the fact that I was also in the corner. I was wearing my bright yellow Tadeo Zapata jacket and trying to act as though I was somehow needed. I have explained this to Max and Go Slow, and assured them that I saw and heard nothing crucial. I was just a spectator. Thus, I cannot be considered a witness. Max and Goslow know I'm here out of love and not money. We watch the third round and count more blows to Tadeo's head. Oscar testifies that when the fight was over, Tadeo thought he had one more round. He was out of it, barely conscious, but still on his feet. After he attacked Sean King and was pulled off by Norberto and others, he was like an enraged animal, unsure of where he was or why he was being restrained. 30 minutes later, as he was changing in the dressing room while the police watched and waited, he began to come around. He wanted to know what the cops were doing there. He asked who won the fight. All in all, not a bad job of creating some doubt. However, even a casual viewing of all three rounds clearly shows a fight that was fairly even. Tadeo dished out as much damage as he absorbed. Mancini gets nowhere on Cross. Oscar sticks to the facts he has created. He was there, in the corner, talking to his fighter, and if he says the kid took too many shots to the head, so be it. Max can't prove otherwise. Next, I call our expert, Dr. Tazelman, the retired psychiatrist who now works as a professional witness. He wears a black suit, crisp white shirt, tiny red bow tie, and with his horn-rimmed glasses and long, flowing gray hair, he looks incredibly smart. I slowly walk him through his qualifications and tender him as an expert in the field of forensic psychiatry. Max has no objections. I then ask Dr. Tazelman to explain in layman's terms the legal concept of volitional insanity, the standard adopted by our state a decade ago. He smiles at me, then looks at the jurors in much the same way an old professor would enjoy chatting with his adoring students. He says, "Volitional insanity means simply that a person who is mentally healthy does something wrong, and at the time he knows it's wrong, but at that moment he is so mentally unbalanced or deranged, he cannot prevent himself from doing it anyway. He knows it's wrong, but he cannot control himself and thereby commits the crime." He has watched the fight many times, and the video of its aftermath. He has spent a few hours with Tadeo. During their first meeting, Tadeo told him he did not remember the attack on Sean King. Indeed, he remembered virtually nothing after the second round. However, during a later session, Tadeo seemed to recollect certain things that happened. For example, he said he remembered the smug look on Crush's face as his arm was raised in victory. He remembered the crowd screaming its disapproval of the decision. He remembered his brother Miguel yelling something. But he remembered nothing to do with the assault on the referee. Regardless, though, of what he remembered, he was blinded by emotion and had no choice but to attack. He had been robbed, and the nearest official was Sean King. Yes, in Dr. Tazelman's opinion, Tadeo was so deranged he could not stop himself. Yes, he was legally insane, and therefore unaccountable for his actions. And there is another, quite unusual factor in play here that makes the case unique. Tadeo was in a cage designed for fighting. He had just spent 9 long minutes trading punches with another fighter. He makes his living punching people. To him, at that crucial moment, it was okay to settle the matter with more punches. Put in context, and in the environment of that instant, he felt as if he had no choice but to do what he did. When I'm finished with Tazelman, we break for lunch. Chapter 26. I stop by domestic relations to check the court file. As expected, old Judge Leaf has denied Judith's request for an emergency hearing and has scheduled the matter 4 weeks from now. His order also states that regular visitation will continue unchanged. Take that, sweetheart. Cliff, partner, and I walk a few blocks to a diner and hide in a booth for a quick sandwich. The morning's testimony could not have gone better for Tadeo. All three of us are surprised at how well Oscar did on the stand, and how believable he was in telling the jurors that Tadeo had been knocked out but was still standing. Few fight fans would believe that, but there are none on our jury. For $20,000, I expected Dr. Tazelman to perform admirably, and he did. Cliff says the jurors are thinking now, with some doubt firmly planted. However, an acquittal is impossible. A hung jury is still our only chance. And it could be a long afternoon as Mancini goes after our expert. Back in court, Max begins by asking, "Dr. Tazelman, at what moment did the defendant become legally insane?" "There is not always a clear beginning and ending. Obviously, Mr. Zapata became furious over the judge's decision awarding the fight to his opponent." "So, before that moment, was he insane by your definition?" "It's not clear. There is a strong likelihood that Mr. Zapata had been mentally impaired during the last few minutes of the fight. This is a very unusual situation, and it's not possible to know how clearly he was thinking before the decision was announced. It's pretty obvious, though, that he snapped quickly." "How long was he legally insane?" "I don't think it's possible to say." "Okay. Under your definition, when the defendant whirled around and struck Sean King with the first punch, was that an assault?"
"Yes."
"And punishable by some standard?"
"Yes."
"And excusable, in your opinion, because of your definition of legal insanity?"
"Yes."
"You've seen the video many times. It's clear that Sean King made no effort to defend himself once he fell to the deck and was sitting against the cage, right?
That appears to be the case.
Do you need to see it again?
No, not at this time.
So, after only two punches, Sean King is down and out, unable to protect himself, right?
That appears to be the case, yes.
10 punches later, his face is bleeding and basically pulverized. He cannot protect himself. The defendant has hit him 12 times around the eyes and forehead. Now, at that point, Doctor, was the defendant still legally insane?
He could not control himself, so the answer is yes.
Mancini looks at the judge and says, "Okay, I want to run the video again in slow motion." The lights are dimmed yet again, and everyone stares at the large screen. Max runs it in super slow-mo and announces loudly as each punch lands, 1, 2, he's down now, 3, 4, 5. I glance at the jurors. They may be tired of this footage, but they're still captivated by it. Max stops with blow number 12 and asks, "Now, doctor, you're telling this jury that they're looking at a man who knows he's doing wrong, violating the law, but cannot physically or mentally stop himself. Is that right?" Max's tone is one of incredulity and mockery, and it's effective. What we're watching is a slaughter by one pissed-off fighter, not a man driven insane.
"That's correct," Dr. Tazelman says, not yielding an inch.
13, 14, 15. Max counts them off slowly and stops at 20. Max calls out, "Now, at this point, Doc, is he still insane?"
"He is, yes."
21, 22, and bodies land on Tadeo as Norberto finally dives on and stops the carnage. Max asks, "How about now, Doc? They've pulled him off and the attack is over. At what point does the boy return to sanity?"
"It's hard to say."
"A minute later? An hour later?"
"It's hard to say."
"It's hard to say because you don't know, right? In your opinion, legal sanity is like a switch that flips on and off, rather conveniently for the defendant, right?"
"That's not what I said."
Max pushes a button and the screen disappears. The lights are brightened as everyone takes a breath. Max whispers to an assistant and picks up another legal pad covered with notes. He shuffles to the podium, glares at the witness, and asks, "What if he hit him 30 times, Dr. Tazelman? You'd still diagnose him as legally insane?"
"Under the same set of facts, yes."
"Oh, we're talking about the same facts. Nothing has changed. What about 40 times? 40 blows to the head of a man who's clearly unconscious. Still legally insane, Doc?"
"Yes."
"This defendant showed no signs of stopping after only 22. What if he landed 100 shots to the head, Doc? Still legally insane in your book?"
Tazelman earns his money with, "The greater number of punches is clearer evidence of a deranged mind."
Chapter 27. It's Friday afternoon, and there's no way we can finish the trial today. Like most judges, Go Slow likes to jumpstart the weekend. She warns the jurors about unauthorized contact and recesses early. As the jurors file out, Esteban Suarez glances my way one more time. It's as if he's still looking for the envelope. Bizarre. I spend a few minutes with Tadeo and recap the week. He still insists on taking the stand, and I tell him that will probably happen Monday morning. I promise to stop by the jail on Sunday and go through his testimony. I repeat my warning that it's never a good idea for the accused to testify. He's taken away in handcuffs. I spend a few minutes with his mother and family and answer their questions. I'm still pessimistic, but I try to hide it. Miguel follows me out of the courtroom and down a long hallway. When no one is listening, he says,
"Suarez is waiting. Contact confirmed. He'll take the money."
$10,000? I ask, just to make sure.
Si, señor.
Then go for it, Miguel.
But just leave me out of it. I'm not bribing a juror.
I guess then, senor, that I need a loan.
Forget it. I don't make loans to clients, and I don't make loans that'll never be repaid. You're on your own, pal.
But we took care of those two thugs for you.
I stop and glare at him. This is the first time he's mentioned Link's boys, Tubby and Razor. Slowly, I say,
for the record, Miguel, I know nothing about those two. If you whacked them, you did it on your own.
He's smiling and shaking his head.
No, senor, we did it as a favor for you.
He nods to partner in the distance.
He asked. We delivered. Now we need the favor returned.
I take a deep breath and stare at a huge stained glass window the taxpayers paid for a century earlier. He has a point. Two dead thugs are worth more than 10 grand, at least in the currency of the street. The breakdown comes with the communication. I didn't request two dead thugs. But now that I benefit from their demise, am I obligated to return the favor? Suarez is probably wearing a wire and maybe even a camera. If the money can be traced to me, then I'm disbarred and headed for prison. I've had close calls before, and I prefer life on the outside. I swallow hard and say,
sorry, Miguel, but I will not be involved.
I turn and he grabs my arm. I shake him off as partner approaches. Miguel says,
you'll be sorry, senor.
Is that a threat?
No, a promise.
Chapter 28.
There are fights tonight, but I've seen enough bloodshed for 1 week. I need to find another sport, and at the moment it happens to be chasing the most lovely Naomi Tarrant. Since we're still meeting on the sly, or at least afraid of being seen by someone who might recognize her as a teacher, we are visiting dark bars and low-end restaurants. Tonight we go to a new place, a Thai restaurant east of town, far away from the school where Naomi teaches Starcher. We are confident we will not be seen by anyone we know. Not quite. Naomi sees her first, and since she can't believe it, she asks me to verify. It's not easy because we don't want to get caught. The restaurant is sufficiently dark, and it has a series of meandering nooks and alcoves. It's a great place to hide and have a meal without seeing many people. As Naomi returns from the ladies' room, she sees three booths in the rear of a dining room. Seated in one of them, side by side and deep in conversation, are Judith and another woman. Not Ava, the current partner, but someone else. A curtain of beads is partially closed at the booth and blocking some of the view, but she is certain it's Judith. Common sense would say that the two women, if only friends or associates or colleagues, would be sitting across the table from each other. But these two women are shoulder to shoulder and lost in another world, according to Naomi. I sneak around to the men's room, duck behind some fake potted plants on a shelf, and see what I desperately want to see. I hustle back to the table and confirm it all with Naomi. I consider leaving and avoiding an embarrassing situation. We don't want Judith to see us, and I'm absolutely certain she doesn't want us to see her. I consider sending Naomi to the car, then crashing Judith's little rendezvous. How cool it would be to watch her melt and start lying. I'll ask about Ava, send my regards. I consider Starcher and what this might mean in the war being waged by his biological parents. His mothers aren't legally married, so I suppose it's okay for one or both to see other women, though I seriously doubt they have an open relationship. How am I supposed to know the rules? But if Ava finds out, there will be even more warfare, more grief for the kid, and more ammunition for me. I consider calling partner and getting him to follow Judith, maybe take some photos. As I consider all of this and sip a whiskey sour, Judith appears from around the corner and walks straight to our table. In the distance, I see her friend leave hurriedly through the front door, one last furtive, tell-all glance over her shoulder. Judith, in full bitch mode, says, Well, well, didn't expect to see you here.
I'm not about to allow her to intimidate Naomi, who's temporarily stricken. I say, didn't expect to see you either. Here alone?
Yes, she says, just picking up some takeout.
Oh, really? Then who's the girl?
What girl?
The girl in the booth. Short, sandy hair, buzzed on one side in the current fad. The girl who just broke her neck getting out of the front door. Does Ava know about her?
Oh, that girl. She's just a friend.
Does the school allow its teachers to date its parents?
It's frowned upon, but not prohibited, Naomi says coolly.
Does Ava allow you to date other people? I ask.
Wasn't a date. She's just a friend.
Then why did you just lie about her? Why did you lie about the takeout? She ignores me and glares at Naomi.
I guess I should report this to the school.
Go ahead, I say. I'll report it to Ava. Is she keeping Starcher while you're out fooling around?
I'm not fooling around, and my son is none of your business right now. You blew it last weekend.
A little Thai guy in a suit eases over and with a big smile asks, Everything okay here?
Yes, she's just leaving, I say.
I look at Judith. Please. We're trying to order.
See you in court,
she hisses and turns on her heels. I watch her leave and she does not take any food with her. The little Thai guy slides away, still smiling. We drain our drinks and eventually look at the menus. After a few minutes, I say, Our secret is safe. She won't say anything to the school because she knows I'll call Ava.
You'd really do that?
In the blink of an eye. This is war, Naomi, and there are no rules, no thoughts of fighting fair.
Do you want custody of Starcher?
No. I'm not a good enough father, but I do want to remain relevant in his life. Who knows? One day he and I might be friends. We spend the night at her place and sleep late Saturday morning. We're both exhausted. We awake to the sounds of heavy rain and decide to fix omelets and eat in bed. Chapter 29. The last witness for the defense is the defendant himself. Before he is called on Monday morning, I hand the judge and the prosecutor a letter I've written to Tadeo Zapata. Its purpose is to inform him in writing that he is testifying against the advice of his attorney. I grilled him for 2 hours the day before, and he thinks he's ready. He swears to tell the truth, smiles nervously at the jury, and immediately learns the frightful lesson that the view from the witness stand is quite intimidating. Everyone is gawking and waiting to hear what he might possibly say in his defense. A court reporter will record every word. The judge is scowling down as if she's ready for a quick reprimand. The prosecutor is eager to pounce. His mother, far away in the back row, looks terribly worried. He takes a deep breath. I walk him through his background: family, education, employment, lack of criminal record, boxing career, and his success in mixed martial arts. The jury, along with everyone else in the courtroom, is sick of the video, so I won't show it. Sticking to our script, we talk about the fight, and he does an adequate job of describing what it was like getting hit so many times. He and I know that Crush did not land many serious blows, but no one on the jury understands this. He tells the jury he doesn't remember the end of the fight, but can recollect a fuzzy image of his opponent raising his arms in a victory that he didn't deserve. Yes, he snapped, though he can't really recall everything. He was overwhelmed by a sense of injustice. His career was gone, stolen. He vaguely remembers the referee raising Crush's arm, then everything went black. The next thing he remembered, he was in the dressing room, and two cops were watching him. He asked the cops who won the fight, and one of them said, Which fight? They put handcuffs on him and explained he was under arrest for aggravated assault. He was baffled by this, couldn't believe what was happening. At the jail, another cop told him Sean King was in critical condition. He, Tadeo, began crying. Even today, he still can't believe it. His voice cracks a bit, and he wipes something from his left eye. he's not a very good actor. As I sit down, Mancini bounces to his feet and calls out the first question.
So, Mr. Zapata, how many times have you gone insane?
It's a brilliant opening, a great line delivered with just enough sarcasm. He proceeds to make a fool out of Taddeo. When was the first time you went insane? How long did it last? Anybody get hurt the first time? Do you always black out when you go insane? Have you seen a doctor for your insanity? No? Why not? Since you attacked Sean King, have you been evaluated by a doctor, one not connected to this trial? Does insanity run in your family? After 30 minutes of this assault, the word insanity means nothing. It's a joke. Taddeo works hard to stay cool, but he can't help himself. Mancini is practically laughing at him. The jurors seem amused. Max asks about his record as an amateur boxer. 24 wins, 7 losses. Max says, Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but 5 years ago, when you were 17 and fighting in the Golden Gloves District Tournament, you lost a split decision to a man named Corliss Bean. That right?
Yes.
Very tough fight, right?
Yes.
Were you upset by the decision?
I didn't like it. Thought it was wrong. Thought I won the fight.
Did you go insane?
No.
Did you black out?
No.
Did you in any way voice your frustration with the decision?
I don't think so.
Well, do you remember it, or did you lose your memory again?
I remember it.
While you were still in the ring, did you hit anybody? Taddeo shoots me a guilty look that betrays him, but says,
No.
Mancini takes a deep breath, shakes his head as if he hates to do what he's about to do, and says,
Your Honor, I have another bit of video that I think might help us here. It's the end of the fight 5 years ago with Corliss Bean. I stand and say, Your Honor, I know nothing about this. It was not disclosed to me.
Max is ready because he's been planning this ambush for weeks. He says with great confidence,
Your Honor, it wasn't disclosed because that was not required. The state is not offering the video as proof of this defendant's guilt. Therefore, under our Rule 92F, there's no disclosure. Rather, the state is offering the video to challenge the credibility of this witness.
Could I at least see it first, before the jury sees it? I ask slowly.
That sounds reasonable, Goslow responds. Let's take a 15-minute recess.
In chambers, we watch the video. Taddeo and Corliss Bean in the center of the ring with the ref, who raises Bean's right hand in victory. Taddeo yanks away from the ref, walks to his corner, yelling something in an angry fit. He stomps around the ring, becoming more unhinged with each second. He walks to the ropes, screams at the judges, and inadvertently bumps into Corliss Bean, who's minding his own business and savoring the win. Others are in the ring, and someone starts pushing. The ref steps between the two fighters, and Taddeo shoves him. The ref, a big guy, shoves back. For a second, it looks as though the ring is on the verge of chaos, but someone grabs Taddeo and pulls him away, kicking and screaming. Again, the camera doesn't lie. Taddeo looks like a sore loser, a hothead, a brat, a dangerous man who doesn't care if he starts a brawl.
Goslow says, Looks relevant to me.
Chapter 30 I watch the jurors as they watch the video. Several shake their heads. When it's over, the lights come up, and Max gleefully returns to the mock insanity crap and hammers away. Taddeo's credibility is thoroughly trashed. I cannot resurrect him on redirect. The defense rests. Mancini calls his first rebuttal witness, a shrink named Wafer. He works for the state mental health department and has credentials that cannot be questioned. He went to colleges in this state and has our accent. He is not the brilliant expert from afar like Tazelman, but he's quite effective. He's watched the videos, all of them, and he spent 6 hours with the defendant, more time than Tazelman. I haggle with Wafer until noon, but score little. As we are breaking for lunch, Mancini grabs me and asks, "Can I talk to your client?"
"About what?"
"The deal, man."
"Sure."
We step to the defense table where Tadeo is sitting. Max leans down and says in a low voice, "Look, dude, I'm still offering 5 years, which means 18 months. Manslaughter. If you say no, you really are insane, because you're about to get 20 years. Tadeo seems to ignore him. He just smiles, shakes his head no. He's even more confident now because Miguel has found the cash and delivered the envelope to Suarez. This I will learn only after it's too late. Chapter 31. After lunch, we meet in chambers, where Goslo has on display a plastic plate covered with sliced carrots and celery, as if we're interrupting her meal. I suspect it's all for show. She asks, "Mr. Rudd, what about the plea bargain? I understand the deal is still on the table." I shrug and say, "Yes, Judge, I have discussed it with my client, as has Mr. Mancini. The kid won't budge." She says, "Okay, we're off the record here. Now that I've seen the evidence, I'm leaning toward a longer sentence, something like 20 years. I didn't buy the insanity stuff, neither did the jury. It was a vicious attack, and he knew exactly what he was doing. I think 20 years is appropriate. May I pass this along to my client? Off the record, of course."
"Please do."
She drowns some celery in table salt, looks at Mancini, and asks, "What's next?" Max says, "I have just one more witness, Dr. Lewandowski, but I'm not sure we need him. What do you think, Judge?" Goslo bites the end of a stalk.
"Your call, but I think the jury is ready."
Chomp, chomp.
"Mr. Rudd?"
"You're asking me?"
"Oh, why not?" Max says. "Put yourself in my shoes and make the call."
"Well, Lewandowski is just going to repeat what Wafer said. I've crossed him before and he's okay, but I think Wafer is a far better witness. I'd leave it at that." Max says, "I think you're right. We'll rest." United, a real team. During Max's closing argument, I keep glancing at Esteban Suarez, who seems to be thoroughly captivated by his feat. He's withdrawn into a cocoon and appears to hear nothing. Something has changed with this guy, and for a second, I wonder if Miguel has managed to get to him. If not with cash, then with threats, intimidation. Maybe he's promised a few pounds of cocaine. Max does a nice job of recapping the case. Mercifully, he does not show that damned video again. He drives home the undeniable point that Tadeo might not have planned his deadly assault on Sean King, but he clearly intended to inflict severe physical injury. He didn't intend to kill the referee, but in fact, he did. He could have thrown one punch or two and stopped. Guilty of assault, but no major crime. But no. 22 vicious shots to the head of a man who could not defend himself. 22 blows delivered by a highly trained fighter whose admitted goal was to see every opponent leave the ring on a stretcher. Well, he achieved his goal. Sean King left on a stretcher and never woke up. Max fights off the natural prosecutorial tendency to beat the drum too long. He's got the jury and he can sense it. I think everybody senses it, perhaps with the exception of my client. I begin by saying that Tadeo Zapata is not a murderer. He's lived on the streets, seen his share of violence, even lost a brother to senseless gang wars. He's seen it all and wants no part of it. That's why his record is spotless. No history of violence outside the ring. I pace back and forth in front of the jury box, looking at each juror, trying to connect. Suarez looks like he wants to crawl into a hole. I play for sympathy and touch slightly on the issue of insanity. I ask the jury for a not guilty verdict, or, in the alternative, manslaughter. When I return to the defense table, Tadeo has moved his chair as far away from mine as possible. Judge Fabineau instructs the jurors, and they retire at 3 p.m. The waiting begins. I ask a bailiff if Tadeo can visit with his family in the courtroom while the jury is out. He confers with his colleagues and then reluctantly agrees. Tadeo steps through the bar and takes a seat on the front bench. His mother, a sister, and some nieces and nephews gather around him, and everybody has a good cry. Mrs. Zapata has not physically touched her son in many months, and she can't keep her hands off him. I leave the courtroom, find partner, and head for a coffee bar down the street. Chapter 32. At 5:15, the jurors file back into the courtroom, and there is not a single smile among them. The foreman hands the verdict to a bailiff, who hands it to the judge. She reads it, very slowly, and asks the defendant to please stand. I stand with him. She clears her throat and reads, "We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of second-degree murder in the death of Sean King." Tadeo utters a soft groan and drops his head. Someone in the Zapata clan gasps from the back row. We sit down as the judge pulls the jurors. One by one, all guilty, unanimous. She congratulates them on a fine job, tells them their checks for jury duty will be in the mail, and dismisses them. When they're gone, she sets deadlines for post-trial motions and such, and gives a date a month from now for sentencing. I scribble this down and ignore my client. He ignores me right back as he wipes his eyes. Bailiffs surround him and slap on handcuffs. He leaves without a word. As the courtroom thins out, the Zapata family makes a slow exit. Miguel has his arm around his mother, who is distraught. Once they're outside in the hallway and within clear view of some reporters and TV cameras, three cops in suits grab Miguel and tell him he's under arrest. Obstruction of justice, bribery, and jury tampering. Suarez was indeed wearing a wire. Chapter 33. Since I lost, I avoid the reporters. My phone is buzzing, so I turn it off. Partner and I go to a dark bar to lick our wounds. I knock back almost an entire pint of ale before either of us speaks. He starts with, "Say, boss, how close did you come to bribing Suarez?" I thought about it. "I know you did. I could tell. But something wasn't right. Plus Mancini was playing it straight, not cheating. When the good guys start cheating, then I have no choice. But Mancini didn't have to. We tried a clean case, which is unusual." I finish the pint and order another. Partner has had two sips of his. Miss Luella frowns on drinking and will say something if she smells it.
"What happens to Miguel?" he asks.
"Looks like he'll be spending time with his brother."
"You gonna defend him?"
"Hell no. I'm sick of the Zapata boys."
"You think he'll sing about Link's thugs?"
"I doubt it. He's in enough trouble as it is. A couple of murders won't help him much." We order a basket of fries and call it dinner. After we leave the bar, I keep the van and drop partner off at his apartment. It's Monday, and Naomi is busy grading tests. "Make sure Starcher gets an A," I tell her. "Always," she says. I need to be loved, but she can't play tonight. I finally go home, and the place feels cold and lonely. I change into jeans and walk down to the rack, where I drink beer, smoke a cigar, and shoot 8-ball for 2 hours, all alone. At 10, I check my phone. Every Zapata in town is looking for me. Mother, an aunt, a sister, and Tadeo and Miguel from jail. Seems they need me now. I'm fed up with these people, but I know they're not going away. Two reporters are calling. Mancini wants to have a drink. Why, I have no idea. and there is a voicemail from Arch Swanger. Condolences on the big loss. How in hell? I need to leave town. At midnight, I load the van with some clothes, the golf clubs, and half a case of small-batch bourbon. I flip a coin, head north, and last for 2 hours before I almost fall asleep. I stop at a budget motel and pay $40 for one night. I'll be on a golf course somewhere by noon, all alone. This time, I'm not sure I'm going back.
3. Thanks for listening. Look for more outstanding John Grisham audiobooks from Penguin Random House Audio wherever books are sold. And for the whole family, we recommend John Grisham's best-selling middle grade series, Theodore Boone, now available on audio from Listening Library. The New York Times says, not since Nancy Drew has a nosy, crime-obsessed kid been so hard to resist. These fast-paced legal thrillers, featuring the clever and determined kid lawyer, Theo Boone, are available on CD and digital download. So make road trips more enjoyable with audiobooks.
This is Mark Deakins. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Rogue Lawyer by John Grisham. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2015 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2015 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.